Case number 15-7039, Carlos Alexander, appellant versus Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. Ms. Rucker for the appellant, Mr. Steiff for the appellee.
Ms. Rucker?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Donna Rucker, for the record, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Carlos Alexander, who has brought this case indicating that the trial court erred when it dismissed his case at the summary judgment stage, since Mr. Alexander properly alleged that he had received a contingent offer of employment, and he advanced as a theory that WMATA refused to give him his job after they put together the fact that Mr. Carlos Alexander is the individual who was the alcoholic. In fact, WMATA was aware that Mr. Alexander had a record of an impairment, a disability, and a reasonable jury could have concluded that the reason that Mr. Alexander was not provided the opportunity to have reemployment with WMATA was due to the fact that there was a known record of his impairment. Alternatively and additionally, Mr. Alexander, we believe, has evidence in this record that will show that he was in fact regarded by WMATA as having a disability and an impairment. The perception is clear, and with this court's de novo review of the evidence in this case, we believe that the record shows that Mr. Alexander was in fact subjected to discrimination due to his disability.
Can I ask you a question actually about the timeliness issue? Do we need to decide whether it's 3 years, the 3-year statute or the 1-year statute, because he didn't exhaust at least a couple of his claims with respect to applications? He only exhausted one of his application claims with the EEOC, correct?
That is correct. I believe that at the time that Mr. Alexander applied, he continued to try to seek employment during the entire process. But for the purposes of the statute of limitations as raised by WMATA, the request is that we consider the timeliness as to whether or not Mr. Alexander needed to file within 1 year versus filing within a 3-year or having a 3-year statute of limitations.
And we have to resolve that question because a number of his claims, he only exhausted one with the EEOC, one of his applications, his first one.
Well, we believe, Your Honor, that at the time that Mr. Alexander filed, and I believe the court in the reasoning provided in the record below agreed with the plaintiff, the appellant in this case, that it's somewhat of a non-issue given the fact that if you're using the D.C. Human Rights Act as a 1-year statute, you have a tolling aspect.
He only exhausted claims, and he only exhausted one of his.
That's not an issue that's raised in this case as a matter of a challenge.
Did he present to the EEOC his application to be an automatic fair collections helper?
I believe that he did, Your Honor.
Understanding was he hadn't exhausted all those claims.
That is not my understanding that the issue here with respect to the tolling is that Mr. Alexander, in fact, had missed the statute of limitations with respect to filing. My recollection is that there's not an issue with respect to the positions that were offered, specifically and most importantly, not with respect to the conditional offer of employment that Mr. Alexander was offered. There's no question, I believe, in the record at this point that the conditional offer that was extended to Mr. Alexander was a position that would have, as I've stated, been one that could go forward because either you have a tolling for that particular offer or you have a 3-year statute of limitations that would not make it an issue. And in this particular case, we believe that WMATA failed to allow Mr. Alexander to go forward on the contingency offer because it relied on and considered.
The contingency offer was for which position?
The court's indulgence, Your Honor. believe the contingency office author, and I'll look to the offer letter that is in the record in this particular case.
Listen, you can tell us. I don't want to waste your time now. If you want to find that and tell me on rebuttal, that would be fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the contingent offer is located on page 269 of the joint appendix. Mm-hmm.
And what date did he file with the EEOC? Do you know that or not? Again, I don't want to waste time filing the papers here.
Certainly, Your Honor. The actual file date with the shall I provide you, however, Your Honor, with the original question of what the actual offer letter was for?
Oh, see, I'm sorry. I'm filing
that's
that
all right.
Here.
It's on 269 mm-hmm. of the joint appendix. With your indulgence, I'll get mm-hmm. there.
Contingent offer says mechanic, helper, general communication.
That is correct. I believe that's the position the court referenced when we were asking.
Yep. Okay.
And so with respect to that, I believe the next question from the court is actually when he filed the mm-hmm. complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So page 260 of the joint appendix.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the EEOC's answer.
That's the action 261 yes. is the actual determination, finding right. discrimination based on
again,
Mr. Alexander's
yeah.
disability.
You can tell me on rebuttal when he submitted his complaint to the EEOC. If
the date that he actually mm-hmm. submitted?
Yeah, you don't need to do that right now.
Thank you.
Move on.
And I'm looking for the charge, which is on page 37 of the joint appendix, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Well, your complaint says it was July 2010.
The actual date of the actual charge is of record in this case has mm-hmm. Mr. Alexander signing his charge on the September 13th, 2010.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so in this particular case, Mr. Alexander's position is that once WMATA was able to make the connection and put together the fact that he is the individual that had the record of an impairment, that he was not going to be offered employment based upon that record of the impairment. And in this particular case, WMATA knew that there was a record of an impairment for Mr. Alexander. During the time that he was employed with WMATA, he went through the employee assistance program where he was treated and received treatment on two separate occasions for alcohol abuse. Mr. Alexander also, during the time that he was employed with WMATA, failed to successfully complete the EAP program. And he also had, as a condition of reemployment, the completion of a substance abuse program, and he would have to wait at least a year from the point of his termination.
Counsel, I just make sure I understand. Are you relying on Section 3.1b rather than 3.1a?
This is of the Rehabilitation Act, Your Honor?
Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry.
That's correct.
Record of such impairment rather than in the actual impairment?
That is correct. We're looking at the fact that there was a record of, and we also believe that the evidence exists with respect to the perception, and alternatively, that existed with respect to Mr. Alexander. We specifically...
You're talking about C as well, then.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And I say that because the record is clear that when Mr. Alexander completed the one-year period and had a one-year period pass, completed the substance abuse program, appeared at WMATA with his certificate, he applied, he was examined, and he successfully passed many exams for positions with WMATA. During that process, Mr. Alexander met with resistance and was in fact told by WMATA officials that you're disqualified because we don't have a revolving door.
Was perception argued below?
Yeah, we did, Your Honor. We indicated that from this evidence that I'm referring to now, we put on the record the fact that individuals perceived him as having this disability or this impairment because, for example, the HR person who was actually processing the paperwork said, I remember you.
No,
I'm
I
going
understand.
To have-
I did not recall that being part of the argument below.
That is what we put in the record. That's found at Joint Appendix number 47. where we specifically noted in the record that Mr. Alexander, when he encountered the HR person, she actually said to him, wait, I remember you. I'm going to have to speak to the superintendent about you.
Did you make an argument?
Did you make the argument?
That is the argument that I advanced.
Wait. I just want to make sure you understand what we're asking. I understand what you're referring to, but when was it crafted into an argument presented to the district court saying we're also arguing perception? It's based on what I just cited, but where is that said?
Well, what the information that I am referring to at this juncture was directly in response to the judge's inquiry about why is it that I'm saying that Mr. Alexander successfully established that he had a disability claim. And I pointed out very specifically by saying, because there's evidence in this record that Mr. Alexander was back, able, and ready to work, he was given a conditional...
But was the perceived theory advanced in a brief or a motion or anything to the district court?
What I'm referring to is actually what was in our brief and what was argued during the summary judgment argument. There was oral argument that was presented.
Did you ever say we're relying on 3.1c?
I never said specifically
That's what we're trying to ask, because we both had the same reaction when preparing the case. We did not see that.
Well, the inquiry from the court, as you will see from the de novo review that you give this record, was whether or not there was an impairment that existed. There was an incredible amount of time spent with addressing whether or not Mr. Alexander had established the fact that he had a disability. My questions and my response, kind of when I reviewed the trial transcript, and it was very important for me to get that, it was clear to me that it's somewhat, my position as I was arguing this case was by the presentation of the arguments and the evidence that exists in the record, that what Mr. Alexander experienced was directly related to the record of the evidence that existed concerning his impairment. And I presented specific examples of what Mr. Alexander encountered when he was trying to become reemployed, advancing the theory that it is the record of his impairment people were reacting to within WMATA, and the perception that somehow or another impaired him from doing the job. For example, the judge, when I was making this argument at Joint Appendix 342, specifically acknowledged that there is a record of the fact that Mr. Alexander is alcohol dependent. I believe that was advanced in response to my advancing the fact that there was this record. The court further says, I am not disputing that. There's evidence in the record that shows your client is alcohol dependent. That was a point and a matter that I was advancing in support of my position that I was not prepared to say that Mr. Alexander did not have an impairment that was being utilized. And to support that example, I pointed very definitively to the fact that you had individuals who were encountering him, referring to and using that record of his disability to keep him from being employed.
You also argue they never rehired an individual who had in the past violated the substance abuse.
That is correct. And at this particular point, Mr. Alexander had passed those things that were required for reemployment. He came with the certificate. It became very much a moving target for Mr. Alexander. It was, you have to wait 1 year, then you have to wait two. Well, now it's three, and then now we're not going to hire you at all.
I'm very confused about how the statute treats alcoholism. Even if it could be established as an impairment, it doesn't look like the defendant has to hire you anyway. It's really confusing.
Would you have the disability that Mr. Alexander had? I believe what WMATA did in this particular case is simply say when individuals are terminated for abuse issues, there's a protocol for being rehired. In Mr. Alexander's case, it was going through a detailed substance abuse program.
Now I'm talking about the statute for a moment.
I understand, Your Honor.
Explain how the statute works together. It's very confusing to me.
Well, as it relates to this case,
alcoholism is a special exception.
Well, I don't believe it's a special exception, but I do believe that alcoholism, as the court pointed out, is not per se a disability. You still have to take it through the standard steps.
No, even if it's a disability, you don't have the. It looks like there's an exception, not requiring the hiring.
But that is not what we have in this case in terms of WMATA standing on why Mr. Alexander is not rehired. In this particular case, in doing a Rule 30b-6 deposition conducted, I specifically inquired about what the court is pointing out. Is there a qualifications issue? That was never the case. Mr. Alexander was never told that you're not qualified to work this position. He was simply repeatedly reminded of the fact that he is that guy who's an alcoholic. That's the record of that impairment.
When you say this position, wasn't there, I mean, does it depend on whether it was safety or non-safety? That's why I asked you about the collections position.
That is correct.
I thought that one was at least debated whether it was a non-safety position, but some of the other ones were safety positions. Would that matter to whether it's the obligation to rehire, whether it's safety or non-safety?
During the course of discovery, there was a distinction made between whether or not someone with Mr. Alexander's disability, his impairment, when coming back, could come back into a safety-sensitive position. What was established, however, is that Mr. Alexander had passed exams for several positions, many of which were not safety-sensitive positions, and the position that he has, or he received the contingency offer on, it is my understanding that it was a non-safety-sensitive position. But there were many positions. The important critical point here, as the court seems to recognize, is that Mr. Alexander was qualified for many jobs. A bright individual, qualified and capable of doing excellent work, never a record of his performance or any incidents during the time that he was employed. He is an alcoholic. And he was terminated for that reason, and he was also not rehired because of the record of that impairment. And also the perceptions of WMATA employees that this individual was not going to be able to function and perform in his job. The record is just simply replete with the evidence that shows that repeatedly his condition was a consideration and a factor in not deciding to reemploy.
Forgetting the perception question for a minute, what is your best evidence on showing that the impairment substantially limits one or more major life activities?
In addition to the information provided during the course of discovery with Mr. Alexander's interrogatories, there's also an expert report presented by Dr. Malone where she recaptures the fact that Mr. Alexander provided to her a detailed history that shows the alcohol dependency is something that had occurred for him at a very young age.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not giving specific evidence with respect to how it's limiting major life activities.
I was about to get to that. Okay. In the same report, the doctor references, and Mr. Alexander himself talks about blackouts after consumption of alcohol, the inability to care for himself, a deterioration of his sleep.
Well, I think the effects on the alcohol cases, as I understand it, showing that there are adverse effects when you drink too much is not what we're talking about.
And I'm not offering it as an adverse.
So if you drink too much and you have blackouts, you can't say that affects a major life activity.
Well, I would argue that blacking out, staying conscious, is a major life activity. But I would also say that it's not just that Mr. Alexander relies on.
Okay.
I would point out that there's a statement of the deterioration of the sleep, his inability to care for himself, and that this is something that has not been and was not during the course of this case disputed in terms of Mr. Alexander, in fact, having a disability. This is the EAP program process that he was allowed to go through.
Do you have to show substantial limitation for a regarded as claim?
I believe that for regarded as, you have to show that that there was a perception that there was an impairment.
But you don't have to show impairment,
that is correct,
but not substantial limitation.
That is my understanding.
Wait a minute, counsel. Here's where I'm a little confused about how the statute works. For B and C, which is you're relying on here, the record of such impairment or being regarding to have such an impairment, neither of those would be established simply because a defendant's individuals believed the plaintiff was an alcoholic. Neither one would be established by virtue of that.
Neither would be established by simply saying that Mr. Alexander is an alcoholic. That's what I was referring to.
Listen carefully to what I'm saying. If I refuse to hire him because he's an alcoholic, that doesn't necessarily violate B or C, does it?
That's not something that's in this case. I'll answer the court.
Well, that's your argument. isn't it?
My argument is that Mr. Alexander had a record of an impairment, and that...
But the mere fact that he's an alcoholic doesn't establish the impairment, right?
The mere fact is, no, because there's no per se standard of disability for an alcoholic.
So a record of such impairment means not just a record of alcoholism, but a record of alcoholism that interferes with a major life activity.
And in this case...
Wait a minute, stop. I just want to make sure I understand it.
That is correct,
sir. So if B and C are not triggered simply because of a record of alcoholism, it's a record of alcoholism that impairs a major life activity. So therefore, anybody who refuses to rehire a plaintiff because he is perceived as an alcoholic doesn't violate the statute unless that perception includes an alcoholic who has a loss of a major life activity.
So the way I can respond to that...
And the answer is yes, isn't it?
I don't want to give an emphatic yes because I don't believe it is. My position is that when you're looking at, for example, as the court is saying here, regarded as, if in this case, as we say, has occurred, the employer mistakenly believes that a person that has a physical impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, that would be an impermissible consideration because you are, in fact, regarding Mr. Alexander as having an impairment.
In other words, you'd have to perceive not that just that he's an alcoholic, but that as an alcoholic, he substantially limits a major activity.
That is correct.
So I'm right.
But not for the regarded as.
That is correct. That is not the standard for regarded as. For regarded as.
The amendments.
Well, having regarded such an impairment. An impairment necessarily includes not just an alcoholism, but an alcoholism that substantially limits life activities.
It is the mistaken belief that a person has an impairment, a physical impairment, that substantially limits.
That you have to have not just a perception he's an alcoholic, but a perception of he's an alcoholic who has a loss of a major life activity. I would have to perceive both of those factors.
Mistaken belief that he has a physical impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities.
Right.
But it's the mistaken belief that is the
I grant you, but if I have a mistaken belief only that he's an alcoholic, that's not enough.
And that is not our case. In our case, we're saying there's a mistaken belief that he cannot perform the duties of the job because you have his application, you have the passing of the exam.
Well, that's all a separate question of he can't perform the duties of the job. We're now focusing on only whether there is a loss of the major life activity. And that can't be because when he drinks on the job, he can't perform the job.
Well, that's,
that would be circular. That doesn't make any sense because the statute says you don't have to hire somebody who drinks on the job.
But that's not my argument. That's what the court is advancing here is a position where we are saying that in this case, when Mr. Alexander appeared qualified and able to begin work, he was regarded as an individual mistakenly with an impairment.
What is an impairment at that point?
The impairment was that he couldn't...
No, technically, what is the impairment?
So the way I have to answer that, Your Honor, is I'm alleging here that WMATA mistakenly perceived that he was impaired. My belief...
What does impaired mean?
And that's what we're saying the record shows.
I want to hear your legal argument.
I'm trying to offer that.
No, you're not. You keep going back to the record and the evidence. What is the impairment at that point that is perceived?
The ability to perform the duties of the job.
That is not a minimum. That you have to have. To have an impairment, you have to have that substantially limits one or more major life activities. So I have to have. If I have a bad perception, violating the statute, the perception has to be, number one, that X is an alcoholic, and number two, that alcoholism impairs a major life activity.
So you're asking me what did WMATA believe his impairment was?
No, I'm trying to figure out your theory.
What's your allegation?
Three different standards.
Correct.
At one point it sounded like you were saying, just merely regarding someone as an alcoholic is a win. That can't be right.
That is not what I'm saying.
All right,
Judge
Silverman is saying, so what it really means is you have to regard someone as being an alcoholic and you have to believe, mistakenly,
correct,
that he's substantially limited in one or major more life activities.
Correct.
But that's actually inconsistent because you're arguing that he is impaired. Well, in major life activities. You're saying that he is impaired.
I am saying that.
So there's no mistaken belief, because you're saying he is impaired, right?
Oh, yeah.
I am saying that he is impaired with respect to a record of, which is a different standard than regarded as. With respect to a record of, the three-step inquiry is whether the employee had a history of a physical or mental impairment. Second.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. My colleague points out that the statute has been amended.
The ADAA, that is
correct. It's been amended to squarely deal with exactly the question I had. Would you like to help?
For regarded as, you don't have to show.
That is correct. You don't have to have that. This is what I was trying to point out.
Yeah. Impairment of life.
Okay.
And so so what we believe is that
you have to show it for the record.
That is correct. That is correct. And we believe that that has occurred with the court's de novo review. That will be discovered. We think that WMATA, knowing about this, relying on this, and that at this point, this leaves a question for the jury as to whether or not the record of the impairment was, in fact, the reason why Mr. Alexander...
But isn't there another provision whereby... Even if there is this, of course, you may argue this not that hasn't been reached yet. And there's still the defendant doesn't have to rehire if the defendant has is an alcoholic who's impaired, can't do the job, or is relevant to the job?
That is a proper inquiry, which is why during the course of discovery, it was important to develop whether or not there was an issue with qualifications from WMATA, and there is none. There was no issue or concern about the ability to do the job.
Even if he was an alcoholic?
And they were aware he was because he had been through their treatment programs.
I see.
And so we feel that in taking this information in a light most favorable to Mr. Alexander, a reasonable jury could conclude that it was the record of his impairment, or alternatively, additionally, the fact that he was regarded as having an impairment as to why he was not reemployed, and that would be a violation of the Rehabilitation Act. We believe that the issue of any statute of limitations is really a non-issue for the reasons already advanced. Therefore, I would respectfully ask the court to reverse and remand this case for trial by jury. Thank you for your time, and if there's any time remaining for me, I'll ask for rebuttal. Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Jared Steve. I'd first like to address, I believe it was Judge Silberman's last question there. I believe the statute that you're referring to is 42 U.S.C. Section 12114, subpart C, 4, and 5. In subpart 4 in particular says that a covered entity, meaning the employer, may hold an employee who engages in the illegal use of drugs or who is an alcoholic to the same qualification standards for employment or job performance and behavior that such entity holds other employees, even if any unsatisfactory performance or behavior is related to the drug use or alcoholism of such employee.
Yeah, but did you ever get to that?
I'm not sure the district court cited that in
her opinion. We don't even get to that issue yet.
I don't think you have to get that far. Are you referring to the statute of limitations?
I'm asking whether that is a secondary question at this point, isn't there? The first question is whether the plaintiff qualifies under A, B, or C, and then of Section 3, and as my colleague points out, C has been amended. So that the first question, does he have a record, or has he been regarded as having an impairment? And then you get to the second question, whether or not alcoholism bars him from the job for the statutory reasons that you've just described, but the judge didn't get to that.
Your Honor,
Yes or no? Did she get to that? I didn't see that she got to that.
I'm not sure she got to it in those words.
Wait a minute. You're not sure. Isn't it fair to say she did not get to that? In fact, there's no evidence on that at all, one way or another.
I believe that's correct.
All right. Well, so there's why are you bringing this up? I was wrong to even raise the question, wasn't I?
Your Honor, I'm not sure you were wrong to raise
it. It confuses the devil out of the statute because it seems to go around in circles.
Well,
but you haven't got to this point yet.
Your Honor, I think there is strong and cogent evidence that he was and is an alcoholic.
That in 10 cents will get you on a trolley car.
Well,
it's not anymore.
It's an old expression. I'm an old judge.
I don't think WMATA does trolley cars.
No, it doesn't. Although trolley cars or street cars are in the news these days, mm-hmm. The district's project. Your Honor, okay. I think what the key thing is, the district court correctly granted summary judgment because the plaintiff failed to demonstrate a major life activity which was substantially limited by alcohol dependency. He was given a second chance at WMATA. First time he was put into the program, he failed that again. And then he was terminated only at that point. Then, at the time of his deposition...
But wait a minute, under C, we're only talking about perception, aren't we?
Well, I'm not sure it's a perception case, Your Honor, where there is actual evidence of the alcohol use.
Perception. It was past alcohol use.
I'm sorry?
Past alcohol use.
Well, Your Honor, and we point this out in Joint Appendix 100-101 from his deposition there. He admitted in his February 2000...
No, you didn't know that at the time you made any of these employment decisions. You can't rely on something he said. That might be after acquired evidence that will limit your damages, but you can't rely on after acquired evidence to justify an employment decision that was made without that information. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, I agree that there's no evidence that they knew he was still drinking.
No, they had no evidence at all that he was drinking.
But I think he has the burden to rebut the showing that we've made in this case that he would have been eligible for it.
He's attacking the decision. This is pretty established in discrimination statutes that... You look at the decision that was made at the time, what evidence the employer had. I didn't see anything here where the employer thought he was drinking. They just didn't like the fact that he'd drunk in the past and he'd violated rules in the past and said, we don't want people like you here. We don't want to open the floodgates. That was the decision that was made. The fact that during deposition in the litigation, he now is confusing about his status, that after acquired evidence goes to limiting remedies. It doesn't change the fact that whether or not discrimination occurred before you had that evidence.
Your Honor, I don't concede that point because I think they have the
burden. I thought the Supreme Court had told us about that, after acquired evidence.
I understand what you're saying about after acquired evidence, but I think the plaintiff had the burden to demonstrate mm-hmm. that he was alcohol-free.
And he did demonstrate that he showed to the employers a certificate and that they had no evidence. And I thought that he got that out during depositions. They had no evidence to think that he was drinking at the time they made these hiring decisions. So doesn't that do that?
Your Honor, I don't...
He doesn't have to show that he's not an alcoholic to satisfy B and C? To satisfy C? I'm confused. What are you responding to? What's your defense on C? Let's start with that. What do you think you have to address C? Being regarded as having such an impairment, the statute is clear now that you don't have to show... substantial limits major life activities.
Your Honor, I don't think C kicks in when there is the evidence, the uncontradicted evidence, that he actually was the alcoholic. I think the regarded as goes to the situation where someone may not have an alcohol problem whatsoever, but they're improperly regarded.
Wait a minute. It says whether it's actual or not.
Actual or perceived.
Actual or perceived. It would have made a lot more sense if the actual wasn't in there, but it is in there. I mean, I'm mystified by the statute, but your problem is it does say actual or perceived.
I can't argue with the words that are in the statute.
That's prudent.
So I mean,
but Your Honor, I don't think this overcomes the 42 U.S.C. Section 12114, and you do have to take that into the equation in making your decision.
What do you mean?
The fact that employers are protected by the need to protect its operations fellow employees.
Well, that's a next question, which wasn't litigated.
And maybe a disputed question of fact. I suspect it's a disputed question of fact. That's
what I'm trying to figure out where you all are coming from on C. So you're kind of stuck with a statute which you admit is really problematic now that it's been changed. And you want to get to the next question, which we can't get to because it wasn't litigated. And then I was going to ask you what you think your best defense is on B, a record of such impairment.
Well, he clearly has a record of impairment. Mm-hmm. I can't say that he doesn't have a record of impairment.
No, I'm asking you, how do you defend if their claim is the disability is a record of such impairment?
Well, there you could argue, counsel, that impairment means the kind of thing I was asking you about amended.
Major life activities.
Yeah.
And then you want to circle back and say that he hadn't really proven the effect on major life activities.
Right, exactly.
Correct.
So you're stuck with C.
C's the problem.
C is the thorn in your side.
Well, wait, can I clarify something on B? I understood your argument to be that at the time he was applying, he didn't show what was going on here, and what his expert was talking about was at the time that he was applying for these jobs, he didn't show that his alcoholism, which at least his claim is that he wasn't actively drinking at the time, didn't affect a substantial life activity. But I didn't understand you to dispute that when he was back in the past actively drinking and when he lost his job, that he wasn't at that time, he didn't at that time have a substantial impairment of a life activity, the sleeping, the concentrating, the blacking out. I mean, you agree that when he's actually drinking, he's got a substantial impairment of a life activity.
Well,
back in when you all fire him.
When he was terminated, mm-hmm. he clearly, I still don't believe that it affected a major life activity at that particular point.
Active alcoholism?
Just by itself is not. And I think Judge Chutkan properly reached that consensus.
I thought I was confused by the timing, because I thought the expert was clear that at the time he was actively drinking, he was blacking out, which would certainly affect your ability to concentrate. It was disrupting his sleep. And so it was sort of hitting some of the things that are major life activities. And that the question was for his showing, whether when he came to the time of applying, he's asserting his rights, not back then, but the time he applied, that's the time period that's at issue for substantial impairment of a substantial life activity. Am I wrong? I thought it was that time period that you...
Your Honor, I think it's both time periods. I'm not sure I followed each thread of it, but I think the plaintiffs have the burden of demonstrating both at the time he was terminated, although my understanding is the termination itself is no longer
an
issue.
Yeah, no, he's not challenging that. That's
what, exactly. But at the time that he reapplied for that. And I think that's what Judge Chutkan focused on.
No, but if he has a record, I think my colleague is pointing out, if in the past, not only did he have problems on the job, but he had problems sleeping, he had problems with other aspects of life, then he did at that point have an impairment of life activity beyond the job. I know it really gets confusing when the impairment of life activity is the job itself. That goes around in circles. Mm-hmm. And the statute doesn't make any sense at that point. But if in the past he has a record of blacking out at home, falling over chairs and so forth, then there's a record of an impairment, right?
That affects a major life activity.
Yes,
then.
A record of impairment. That's why I'm saying that it is a life major life activity.
It could get to that level, but the plaintiffs didn't, as Judge Shokin properly pointed out, produce evidence along those
that's
lines.
That's why I'm asking. We're not saying they win. They win here. I'm just saying there is evidence here about blacking out, couldn't recollect events, deterioration, ability, occupational difficulties generally. When someone gets what sounds like a pretty progressed stage, that at least back then, mm-hmm. it impaired a life activity.
And that's the catch-22 that we reference in our brief there. I don't know how they can
make that argument to support their claim of a major life activity and yet meet the standard that they qualify for the job.
But they haven't got to that point. You haven't got to that second question. You're jumping ahead because your attack was whether or not there was a diminution of a major life activity, mm-hmm. not whether
there's a disability.
If there was a diminution, he couldn't perform the job. You didn't get to the job.
Well, right? We certainly argued that.
I didn't know that was the reason you had declined.
Did the district court make some findings on that? Now, the district court, the district court did find, this is why I was perplexed with the original argument, the district court specifically found that B and C were not raised by the plaintiff.
Right.
Well, why didn't you say that?
We're
dancing around here. I mean, you all are supposed to be working on the record. The district court, right or wrong, the district ADA also defines disability as a record of impairment or being regarded as having. The court found, however, that Alexander did not allege either of those definitions as the basis for his claim. Well, you haven't said a single thing about that.
Well, and Your Honor, apologies, but the
focus... No, I don't have to apologize. It's a good way to lose a case, but I'm not understanding. We're trying to figure out what the arguments are here. That was why I asked counsel on the other side initially, was that raised? Now I recall that the district court specifically said it was not raised.
Yes.
Well, are you...
And we would try to submit that they have waived it by doing so. I believe that's correct.
Right at the outset.
Yeah, why wouldn't that be your first argument? I'm not getting this case. Why are you... We're talking about the statute being amended and on, and your answer should have been, it doesn't matter.
That they waived it by...
Because B and C are not in play here, but you didn't argue that. So we could say you waived it too. You waived the response to the waiver. I mean, this isn't making any sense. We're trying to get some clarity here. Is that your argument or not?
Oh, yeah, yes, it would be my argument. It is my argument.
Did you make the point in the brief that B and C were not relied on below?
I do not believe we said that, but I don't think the plaintiff argued it.
You don't know what you argued in the brief on those 2 points? At the appellate court, those are critical matters. You didn't raise that in your brief?
Maybe the district court was wrong, since you were talking, all the evidence was about not rehiring people who violated a substance abuse policy in the past.
Well, wait a minute. Now I'm really confused, because did the appellant assert that the district court erred by stating that B and C were not raised? Right. If the appellant didn't assert that, then you're not at fault for not responding. But this is really getting very confusing.
Well, they briefed record and regarded as... in their opening brief, right? They've argued it, and they cited in their record where they raised it below, correct?
Well,
but did they challenge the district court? We can ask them when they come back. But the district court is very specific in saying B and C were not raised.
Your Honor, if I may just briefly address, because I know my time's expired, but the statute of limitations issue is a very important issue, because there are other cases in the pipeline at the district court.
Yes, but I think you're actually, if you had to decide, I think you're right. It's a one-year statute, because it's much more logical to analogize. I don't care what the other circuits have done. It's much more analogous to a discrimination statute than it is a tort. In the typical tort is often the plaintiff doesn't know what the consequences of a injury may or a tort would be for years, which is why you have a 3-year statute. When it's discrimination, that isn't the problem. So the 1-year statute makes more sense. But so what? If you take the 1-year statute in the district, you should also take the tolling.
Right.
Your Honor, Jaiolo says that. But how? The difference between Jaiolo, if I'm pronouncing it right, in this case is, in Jaiolo, they had the D.C. Human Rights Act, which specifically provides or allows them to take the administrative route. The Rehabilitation Act cases should not go to the EEOC. There's no jurisdiction for the EEOC to do that. If this was a Title VII case, even if it was an ADA case.
You're relying on the Supreme Court case in Johnson.
Exactly, Your Honor. Precisely. And Judge Urbina got it in the Adams case. Now, admittedly, Adams came out before J. Aiello, so he was thinking it was a three-year statute. But put that aside, plug in the one-year statute with that. The rationale that Judge Urbina advanced in the Adams case is totally consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson.
It's awfully confusing, though, because at least as to Rehabilitation Act claims against the government directly, we have precedent that holds that its exhaustion is mandatory and jurisdictional.
But that's not the case for a state-level interstate compact agency like WMATA.
Well, but that's the confusion, then, about whether they should follow the ADA model of exhaustion or the Rehab Act one. You can imagine how confusing it would be for somebody.
Right.
Because if they look at you as a government, then they've got to exhaust. If they look at you as private, then they're doing the ADA private exhaustion route, and you say neither one works. It's best if you don't exhaust at all.
That's right. And the plaintiffs, at a minimum, should have filed if they thought they might have to go to EEOC. They should have filed a protective suit or whatever. The one-year statute applied has run, and the case is untimely. If you take the Johnson rationale from the Supreme Court, which I respectfully submit this court must do.
The D.C. Court of Appeals adopted that and said that the exhaustion, its tolling provision only applies to mandatory exhaustion?
I
didn't think they had.
I don't think that they have gotten into that. I've shepherdized J. Aiello and all, and I didn't see anything along those lines. But in J. Aiello, they were particularly dealing with the D.C. Human Rights Act, which specifically allowed the plaintiff, I believe it was the option there, I don't think it was mandatory, to seek the administrative relief. That is not the case there. In this case, should be barred by the one-year statute of limitations. The court may feel this is a tough thing for plaintiffs to meet, but Congress can always change the statute of limitations should they deem it necessary to do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Rucker, we'll give you 2 minutes.
We have a question for you right at the outset. Did you challenge the district court's determination that B and C were not involved in the case?
Yes, we did.
Where?
Our brief.
You did?
Yes. We specifically point out those areas that I was offering to the court as to why we feel there was a record.
No. I want to be really clear on this because this case has gotten very confusing. So you may not have done it this way, and after you answer my question, you can say, no, I didn't, but I did it this way. In this situation, my perception of how this would come up is district court made very specific findings. B and C are not in play. Counsel on the other side objecting to that would have section whatever A we went under. Now we're moving to the next section, B. The district court was wrong in that determination. We raised it, and here's our argument on B. Next section, district court was wrong on C in saying we didn't raise it. We did. Here's our argument. Is that in your brief? I don't remember that.
It is.
Where?
You have separate sections on B and separate sections on C?
We believe, with respect to, I'm going to try and find the actual page.
That's helpful.
Of course, and don't.
I think it's page 8. District Court erred in finding that
correct.
Mr. Alexander does not allege record or history. On page 8 at the top?
That is correct.
Page 8 of
Of the blue brief.
Of the blue brief?
Top of the page.
And what we did was in that making.
I'm not saying you didn't. I'm just confused and I don't remember. So
I want you to have
an opportunity
sure.
to tell me so I'll know what to look at when I walk out of here.
And we did. And specifically, what I think is also important is the inquiry made by the court for WMATA. During the course of both.
I see where you've made the statement on page 8. Excuse me. Now, where do you elaborate that?
So in other words, did you follow the model? I'm not saying the Edwards model is the only model, but did you do the Edwards model of a brief? That is, okay, district court was wrong, and here's our argument on B. District
yes.
court was wrong, here's our argument on C. And what pages are all of those arguments fleshed out?
Let me point the court's attention to the joint appendix, which is...
No, the brief.
Well, the brief is in the joint appendix.
No. Your brief in this court is what we're talking about.
Oh, you mean the brief that we filed with the court?
Yes.
Okay. Your indulgence.
That's what
we read.
That's what I'm trying to say. Where did you pull out those two arguments and say, this court's wrong, here are our fleshed out arguments on B and C?
I understand. So, starting on page 12 of our brief, the caption reads, the record evidence gives rise to material facts in dispute as to whether Mr. Alexander's alcoholism substantially limited a major activity, and on the very next page says, under A, Mr. Alexander had a record of a disability at the time of his non-selection.
And what about C? 14 to 16 to C?
Your indulgence, Charles.
I think it's page 23, maybe?
That is correct. At the bottom of page 23, under C, it indicates alternatively, WMATA regarded Mr. Alexander as having a disability at the time of his non-selection. What I was going to address as well is the fact that during the course of both the briefing and the discovery and the filing of a summary judgment motion in the opposition file, at no point did WMATA articulate or ever indicate that Mr. Alexander did not meet the standards under either regarded as or record of. As a matter of fact, the issue of whether or not Mr. Alexander said or argued that there was a regarded as or record of was for the first time found by the appellant in the footnote for Judge Chutkin's opinion. There's nothing in the record of the trial transcript where there's any discussion or any concession or waiver. As a matter of fact, it has been our position all along, as referenced in our briefs and presented here today, that that was something that was argued and presented.
Can I ask you something about, you talk about a contingent offer that he got. What is a contingent offer? I mean, it's got to be contingent on something, and it sounded like you still had to go through a physical exam, maybe background checks. So does a contingent offer say anything about whether they think he's qualified subject to qualifications coming after? Are they part of the contingent standpoint?
The contingent offer had to do with what you just stated, the medical exam, background checks, and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with any issues with respect to qualifications. So Mr. Alexander, as we indicate in this record, met the qualifications after receiving the contingent offer, met the remaining qualifications for being allowed to have employment with WMATA, and was denied that based upon his disability.
And then also, this really jumps ahead just for my own understanding. Even if he were an existing alcoholic, is it your view that under the statute, the WMATA could not refuse to hire him unless there was evidence that he used alcohol on the job?
Even if he's an existing alcoholic, my response would be that alone would not be a basis for WMATA not to.
But if he used alcoholism on the job, that is it.
If he
That's what the statute says, right?
Exactly. If he was using alcohol on the job, correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Your additional argument, as I'm now putting it all together, finally, is that you raised B and C, contested the district court, explained your position, and you're further saying, and look, the government didn't contest our contest.
That is correct.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The case is submitted.
Thank you.
Stand, please.